Chapter 10, Search for Strangers. The good weather turned bad, and dark clouds hung low over the New Jersey coast. It was appropriate weather for the state of mind at Spindrift. With Mark's a victim of the mysterious dagger of the mind, only Dr. Morrison remained of the original team. The question, of course, was who was next? At Hearts and Brand's urgent request, Steve Ames visited the island, and a meeting of all the staff was called in the big library. Rick and Scotty sat on a library table, while the scientists occupied the few library chairs. Steve Ames sat on Hartson Brandt's desk and acted as chairman for the informal session. By mutual agreement, the girls had been excluded. Jan was nearly in a state of shock over what happened to Marks. Not only was she fond of the crusty scientist, but she was fearful that the mysterious ailment would strike her father next. And Barbie was rapidly catching the same fear. After all, new team members probably were not immune, and Hartson Brandt, Julius Weiss, and Parnell Winston were deeply involved in the project. Steve called the meeting to order.
Hartson, you suggested that I come, which I was glad to do. Suppose you start by telling us what you had in mind.
Very well, Steve. The scientist glanced and braced his colleagues and the boys. We have a problem that must be solved before we can continue with calm and objective minds on the project that faces us. The problem is simply, what is the ailment that has stricken three of us, and what is its cause? Hartson Brandt tamped tobacco into his pipe thoughtfully. Let us see what we know. First of all, two team members were stricken in Washington, within a short time of each other. They were examined by competent specialists who arrived at no conclusion. They admitted they were unable to diagnose the ailment. The possibility of an unknown disease was considered briefly, but not seriously. The possibility of a chemical agent, a drug if you like, also was considered. This possibility has not been entirely rejected. However, a detailed laboratory investigation disclosed no trace of chemicals in the patients, apart from chemicals that were expected, of course.
Could there be chemicals that left no trace? Scotty asked.
Hartson Brandt shook his head. No one can claim total knowledge of body chemistry, obviously. Just the same, the elements to be found in the body and the proportions in which they occur are well known. I said the possibility has not been entirely eliminated, but it seems unlikely that chemical interference caused the disruption.
What does that leave? Steve inquired.
The scientist shrugged. I can't even guess. Physical interference, perhaps? There is also a possibility, which is very difficult to explore, that the ailment was caused within the minds of the scientists by some catalytic agent, or by some psychic trauma that we can't even imagine. Rick and Scotty exchanged glances. They had seen the ailment at work, and even its effects were almost beyond description. Its cause was hard to imagine. But to continue, Steve recognized the possibility that the ailment was caused by some outside source. Call it an enemy source, if you prefer. He acted to get the remaining team members beyond the reach of the enemy by smuggling them to Spindrift. He succeeded with Dr. Miller. Excuse me, Dr. Morrison. He did not succeed with Dr. Marks. What does that suggest?
That hiding Dr. Morrison was an effective preventative, Steve Ames concluded.
If he is hidden, Rick said the words before he even thought.
What do you mean, Rick? No one outside the family or the project knows of his presence, Julius Weiss exclaimed.
Steve held up his hand.
Hold it a minute. We'll get to that point in its proper turn.
Hartson Brandt picked up the threads again. We will assume for the moment that Steve's statement is correct, and that hiding Dr. Morrison was a preventative. I know Steve doesn't accept this fully, but we must use assumptions since we have no facts of consequence. If the assumption is correct, then we have to accept the fact that enemy agents are interested in the project. and we must accept that they have some means of creating a mental block by remote control. Rick stole a glance at Parnell Winston. The cyberneticist was sitting quietly, his bushy eyebrows knitted thoughtfully. Winston hadn't said a word. Hartson Brandt paced the floor as he went on. We now have one slight bit of additional information that supports the theory of enemy interference. You are all aware of what happened to Dr. Marx this morning. He is in the hands of Constantine Chavez, who is in touch with the physicians in charge of the other team members. Dr. Chavez is of the opinion that Dr. Marx's mental injury was caused by physical means, although he cannot say how. He also states, although there seems to be no connection with mental injury, that Marx was drugged. Parnell Winston spoke up for the first time.
Steve, if Chavez says Marx was drugged, we can accept it. How could it have happened?
Steve spread his hands in a gesture that seemed to Rick to indicate embarrassment. I've gone over every step of the journey with Tom Dodd. The answer is yes. Thanks to Mark's bullheadedness and a clerical error, there was an opportunity for an enemy to get to him on the train. The scientist waited, obviously wanting to know more. Steve elaborated. Marx was covered by one of our men at every moment, even while he was working at the Bureau of Standards and while he was at his apartment. The agents drank and ate the same things. Nothing happened to them. However, when the reservations were made for the train trip, Marx specified that he wanted a bedroom. He got one, and Tom Dodd got the one next door. Why did Marx want to travel by train overnight anyway? Scotty demanded. That's getting from Washington to Newark the hard way. I told you he was stubborn, Steve reminded him. Tom tried to talk him out of it, but failed. After all, the project team members aren't prisoners. We can't use force, and we can't order them to do anything. Marx wanted to go overnight by train because he always traveled that way, he said. He insisted. Dr. Morrison said sadly,
I assure you that he is not an easy man to get along with sometimes, but we must remember that he is, or was, an extremely competent scientist. Competence like his can be forgiven many eccentricities.
Thanks to his eccentricities, we've also lost his competence, Julius Weiss pointed out. Go on, Stephen.
Right, well, Tom specified bedrooms A and B, and by the time he got the reservations and found out he had actually received bedrooms B and C, it was too late because the train was sold out.
I can't see what difference that would have made, Rick objected.
You will. People often buy connecting bedrooms on a train. That's what Tom had done. He planned to keep the connecting door open and remain awake all night with an eye on Marx. However, while A and B connect, B and C do not. Am I making myself clear?
I think so, Rick agreed. The connecting bedrooms come in pairs, A, B, C, D, and so on.
That's it. Well, Tom ran a fast check on the person who had received bedroom D and found it was a Baltimore businessman who often traveled on the same train, going overnight to New York. So Tom didn't worry about it. Instead, he kept his bedroom door open so he could watch the corridor. He says he didn't sleep at all, and I believe him. He's one of my best agents. The occupant of bedroom D came on the train at Baltimore and went right to bed. The night passed quietly until it was time to get Marx up. Tom had great trouble waking him up, and he was groggy until this strange effect hit him. Rick and Scotty know. They were there.
The boys shuddered, remembering Marx's condition.
But where did the opportunity to drug him come in? Weiss asked.
We've done some fast checking on every possible angle, Steve said quietly, and we found a couple of interesting things. First of all, the man who reserved bedroom D is in a Baltimore hospital. He was struck by a hit-and-run car as soon as he walked from his office to the railroad station. Obviously, he was struck deliberately. He's in critical condition.
Then the man on the train wasn't the businessman, Rick gasped.
Yes. So who was he? We don't know.
We've had our Boston office go over the room, and they've turned up no fingerprints except those of the porter who cleaned up after the train left New York. The room was wiped clean, but our Boston men also found an interesting spot on the rug. They had a sample analyzed, and so far as we can determine, it's a kind of water-soluble salt paste often used by doctors when they take electrocardiograms. The group leaned forward, interested. Rick knew the kind of stuff that Steve meant because he had once watched Zircon getting an electrocardiogram. The big scientist had fainted from sheer overwork, and possible heart complications were suspected. The technician squeezed the paste from a tube and applied it to wrist, ankles, and chest under the metal terminals of the machine. Its purpose was to allow better electrical contact. Julius Wise demanded excitedly,
"Steve, do you imply this unknown person took an electrocardiogram of Marx's heart responses?"
The Yannick agent shrugged. "I imply nothing. I'm merely reporting what we found." Again, Parnell Winston spoke.
"Perhaps I can shed some light on this. It's true that such an electropaste is used to make better connections for electrocardiograms. But perhaps of greater importance for this discussion, is also used in making electroencephalograms."
Rick and Scotty spoke in unison.
"What?"
Winston turned to them.
"It's a long word, but not a difficult one. Electro for electrical. Encephalo is simply a Greek form meaning the brain. Gram, also from Greek, meaning something drawn or written. A record, if you like. So, an electroencephalogram is simply an electrical recording of the brain."
"That may be significant," Hartson Brandt said thoughtfully. "But assuming that an enemy could get an EEG, which is a handy way of saying electroencephalogram, Rick and Scotty, what would he do with it?" Parnell Winston rose.
"Hartson, I think you can conduct the rest of this without me. I have an extraordinary notion whirling around in my head I'd like to discuss with Chavez. I'll pick up the car at the pier and drive over, if you don't mind. And by the way, Steve, can Yannick get some information for me?"
"We can try."
"Good. I want to know if the two team scientists who were stricken first had EEGs made after the attack. I would also like to check their medical history as completely as possible, to find out if EEGs were ever taken while they were normal."
"I'll give the orders right away," Steve agreed. "I don't know what we can turn up on their early medical history, but we can try." Parnell Winston departed. Rick almost wished he had asked permission to accompany Winston, but there was more to be said here, too.
"The evidence is not conclusive," Hartson Brandt summed up, "but it is certainly strong enough to warrant a clear assumption. We have an enemy who, by unknown means, can inflict brain damage."
"All right, now for some loose ends." Steve looked at the boys. "Rick and Scotty turned up a barber in Whiteside. It happened they had first seen him in the project building in Washington, so they got his name and called. We were already checking on the barber and knew he was in Whiteside. We'll dig deeper until we know more about him than he does. For now, our information indicates he's just what he claims to be. He got the job in Whiteside legitimately. He had planned to take a new job for a long time. So far as we can tell, he's as innocent as a woolly lamb."
"Just the same," Rick said stoutly, "I'm not satisfied. I'd like to get some more dope on that massage machine of his, especially after what Dr. Winston said."
Steve grinned. "Why don't you then?" Rick and Scotty looked at each other and rose to the challenge. "We will," they stated flatly. Steve nodded. "All right. You're known on Whiteside and my men are not. An influx of strangers, or even one inquisitive stranger, would attract attention. But that's not all. I have another job for you, too." They waited eagerly. "I want a survey of the area. My Boy Scout team can help somewhat, but they're strangers here, too, even though they have an explanation for their presence. Scan the area for anything suspicious.
Get your newspaper pals on the job and have them sniff around for evidence of any strange folk in the area. They can do it easily.
We'll do it, Rick agreed. There was nothing hard about looking for strangers in their own territory. He knew exactly how to go about it.
All right, search for strangers, get your pals on the job, but do it without tipping anything off. That state police captain you've worked with will be a great help, too. Tell him national security is involved, but that's it.
At least we're not working entirely in the dark anymore, Dr. Morrison said wearily. Even if the assumption of an enemy is wrong, it's something to go on.
Rick stood up. The conference was apparently at an end.
Tonight we'll plan, he announced, and tomorrow we'll start. If there are any strangers in the area, you'll have full particulars by tomorrow night.
That, said Steve Ames, is a promise I'll hold you to.